The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Good afternoon. We are very happy to have you here today, although we are sorry it's not in person. We will begin with our first case, United States versus Villa. And Ms. Hester, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. For a year before arresting him, police had been investigating Francisco Villa on suspicion of drug offenses without finding sufficient evidence of probable cause. As the district court recognized, the police retired their waiting and resorted to a pretextual traffic stop, which culminated in a warrantless search of Mr. Villa's home and a subsequent arrest for possessing marijuana, drug paraphernalia, and guns. The district court concluded that Villa's consent to the search was involuntary and suppressed its fruits, which led to dismissal of the original alien with a firearm charge. But after losing the suppression issue, the government charged Villa with aggravated illegal reentry, which presents the court with several constitutional issues. I'll address why Villa's fingerprints and the records found with them should be suppressed as a fruit of the unlawful search, and then I'll address the vindictive prosecution issue. The district court relied on a legally erroneous interpretation of this court's decision in Oscar Torres when it denied Villa's motion to suppress. The court ruled that the exclusionary rule only applies to the fingerprints if officers arrested Villa for the investigative purpose of obtaining his fingerprints and the fingerprints were not obtained during a routine booking process.
Ms. Hester, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have sort of a threshold question about the suppression and exclusionary rule analysis here. I'm having trouble with the very first step in the analysis, right? Which is that the evidence has to be discovered because of an illegal seizure. And that's sort of the bare minimum. And then even after that, we ask some additional question, which, you know, we are here to discuss under Davis and Hayes and our decision in Oscar Torres. But I am not clear as to why we're even in that territory here, because it doesn't look to me as though the illegal Fourth Amendment search here, which was the search of the home, was necessary to getting the fingerprints, because it seems as though your client, there was probable cause to arrest your client on state drug charges, even independent of the illegal search of the home, and probable cause to bring him in on the federal unlawful presence charge based on the statements he made during the legal encounter on the street. So I don't know if I'm framing my question right, but it seems to me we don't even have but-for causation here. And that's sort of the bare minimum. And then you get into the question of what else you need.
Well, I think that's actually more a question of inevitable discovery. And the government has the burden of proving inevitable discovery under Nix versus Williams.
Why is that the question? Why is it I don't think it is an inevitable discovery question. I guess I'm asking, why isn't it just the first order question? Did they get this evidence because of the illegal search of the house? And if the answer is he was arrested and could have been arrested based only on the evidence from the legal encounter on the street.
Because I believe the evidence was that they didn't want to arrest him for those charges. And furthermore, with respect to the state charges, the only contraband found before the search of Villa's home was drug paraphernalia. And an arrest for that charge doesn't even result in fingerprinting under the North Carolina statute. So as far as that's concerned, that wouldn't have resulted in fingerprints. They had to get the fingerprints in another way. But the officer testified repeatedly that he wasn't going to arrest him. He wasn't under arrest at the point where they found the vape pen in his pocket and he had the discussion with him. And in fact, he testified that they arrested him on the state charges as a placeholder so that he could further investigate the federal charges.
So you're saying, I think I understand now about inevitable discovery. You're saying maybe they could have arrested him on those charges, but they didn't,
right,
based on that evidence, but they didn't. So now the burden is on them to show that they would have arrested him,
right,
based only on the legally obtained evidence. Okay.
Right. Right. So the district court's analysis of conflicts with Oscar Torres and impermissibly restricts the exclusionary rule. The correct rule under Oscar Torres is whether officers intend or expect that an arrest will lead to criminal prosecution. And here, no one can reasonably dispute that police were motivated by a criminal investigation and planned prosecution when they arrested V and had him fingerprinted. Most importantly, they arrested him on criminal charges.
Counsel,
yes.
Counsel, on that point, I was a little unclear on what you think we said in Oscar Torres. Can you, you just said it has to do with whether there are criminal charges or criminal investigation. Can you articulate for me, police cannot take fingerprints if what?
So the rule in Oscar Torres is the correct test is whether officers are intend or expect that an arrest will lead to criminal prosecution. And really the only reason that Oscar Torres—
The reason I'm asking is because isn't that always the case, right? You're arrested on criminal charges for a criminal prosecution. That seems to always be the case. So I understand your rule must be more nuanced than that, but I'm having trouble understanding what it is.
Well, I actually don't think that it is more nuanced than that because Oscar Torres only came into existence because of the administrative detention and fingerprinting that took there during an immigration investigation. And the court in Oscar Torres went through a whole analysis of the deterrent value of the exclusionary rule in the two different contexts and explained exclusion wouldn't deter unlawful arrests intended solely for deportation because the exclusionary rule doesn't even apply in deportation proceedings.
Yeah, I think the context is very important for Oscar Torres. I think you're right. And perhaps I'm being too simplistic, but could you state your rule for me when officers can't take fingerprints when or if what?
Well, they can't take fingerprints if it's the result of an illegal arrest, but that's not the end of the analysis because the court then will apply the Wong-Sun analysis to determine whether those fingerprints were obtained by exploiting the illegality or instead by some other means that's sufficiently distinguishable to be purged of the primary taint.
And so you you haven't argued on appeal that this was an illegal arrest.
No, we are arguing that it is the fruit of the illegal search of his home. That's correct.
Okay.
So, but I think that even under a different test, even under a test that is more narrowly tailored to the intent of officers, that the fingerprints would still be excluded here. Because before Villa was even arrested on state or federal charges, the officers here were investigating him for federal charges involving his immigration status, charges that they knew would involve running his fingerprints during the investigation. And that was borne out.
I'm sorry to keep coming back to this, but so you said the rule is that officers can't take fingerprints if it's the result of an illegal arrest. You're not arguing on appeal that this was an illegal arrest. So why is this an issue?
We are arguing that it is an illegal arrest because the arrest was the fruit of the unlawful search, to be clear.
I didn't see anything in your brief saying there wasn't, you know, probable cause to arrest or anything like that.
No, and we don't make that argument because there was probable cause, but it was based on the evidence they discovered during the unlawful search.
But you did say, I think you agreed with me, that there was, in fact, probable cause independent of the illegally obtained evidence that would have supported an arrest. It's just that they chose
not to use that to arrest him because they didn't want to arrest him for that. They had, you know, they wanted to arrest him for a more serious charge, one that they wouldn't have to release him on. They did not want to arrest him for the vape pen. It's clear that they
can I ask, it's possible that I'm going to be overlapping a little bit with Judge Rushing, and I apologize. What I am trying to get a handle on is, let's assume for purposes of the argument that there's an illegal arrest here. And so now we're trying to figure out, as you said, when is the taking of the fingerprints sufficiently attenuated from the illegal arrest that got the person into the station house and in a position to have his fingerprints taken. And I would have thought that the answer under Davis and Hayes and Oscar Torres is, if the arrest was for the purpose of getting the prints to tie this person to a specific crime, like you've got a crime, you're trying to figure out who did it, and so you start, as in Davis and Hayes, just kind of rounding people up to see if you can match their prints to that crime. And that seems very different to me from doing something like arresting someone and doing a standard sort of criminal investigative check. Are there outstanding warrants? Does this person use an alias? What can we find in our databases about this person? Is that not right?
I may have lost the thread there, Your Honor.
Fair enough. Like, I realized there wasn't really a question. I guess
But what I will say is, even with a narrower test, I mean, even if you look at the intent of the officers here in making the arrest, I think that the agent or Detective Stewart was pretty clear on page 335 of the joint appendix that he was placed under arrest for the state charges for the marijuana until I could further the investigation on the firearms that were present in the house. So his entire purpose in arresting him on these state charges was to conduct exactly the kind of investigation that happened.
But they didn't need his fingerprints to tie him to the guns.
Well, they needed the fingerprints in order to tie him to a status that would make his possession of the guns illegal. Because
he told them that he was here illegally.
It's not clear whether Stewart fully understood that until he had the Spanish-speaking INS officer or HSI officer speak to him. I think that is the point in which it was clear that he was here illegally, and not before. And that was all part of the investigation that was intended, you know, that was done while they were using the state charges as a placeholder. I would like to take a moment to move to the vindictive prosecution question, because that also presents some significant issues. The prosecutor's decision to charge Villa with a more serious offense after he prevailed on his suppression motion violated due process, because in this situation, there is a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness. The Sixth Circuit's decision in United States versus Ladeau, as well as this court's decisions in Wilson and Corbett, support applying a presumption of vindictiveness. In Ladeau, the Sixth Circuit explained that the prosecutorial stake in a successful dispositive suppression motion is virtually the same as the stake that the Supreme Court identified in Blackledge is sufficient to justify a presumption. Villa's successful motion eviscerated the government's case, and the prosecutor had to dismiss it and begin again from square one. Ladeau isn't distinguishable from this case in any meaningful way. As on Ladeau, the prosecutor had charging options, and he chose to charge the more serious aggravated illegal reentry offense instead of the less serious entry offense.
Well, isn't it distinguishable in the main way that the parties are arguing over, which is the district court's factual finding that the government didn't have a reason to charge the aggravated reentry offense until much later, when it discovered the alias and, you know, these other charges and these other convictions, right? So, I mean, that's the big difference with Ladeau, and it all comes down to the district court's fact finding that the parties disagree about.
Well, I think it comes down to actually what legal standard the court wants to apply in determining whether the presumption applies or not. And the question is, does that standard require the prosecutor to have knowledge, or is it enough that the reentry charge was available all along? And Supreme Court decisions and this court's decisions support applying a standard of availability.
Isn't vindictive prosecution a genuine animus standard? We've said, the Supreme Court have said that, I mean, the two prongs, the prosecutor has to act with genuine animus, and the defendant wouldn't have been prosecuted but for that animus. So how can we create a sort of idea that the prosecutor has all the knowledge of the government, which makes a lot of sense in the Brady, you know, producing materials context? Why does that make sense in a context where we're asking, did this prosecutor have genuine animus against this defendant?
Well, I think it makes more sense to apply that question in the rebuttal stage than in the presumption stage, because the Supreme Court's decisions in Godwin, Pierce, Blackledge, and this court's decision in Bail and Wilson all focus on the availability or of the charges, or the question whether it was impossible to bring the charges in the first instance, which it wasn't in this case.
Can I ask you a question about in the very similar context of vindictive sentencing, you know, if someone wins on appeal and goes back down and gets a higher sentence, I thought the Supreme Court had made pretty clear that there's no presumption and or the presumption is rebutted if the district court in resentencing is relying on information that it didn't know about the first time it sentenced, whether or not like the thing itself had happened before or after the original sentencing. In other words, it was what was in the district court's head, not what information might have been available out there in the world. Does that seem like it would transfer over
to
this
context? I'm not sure that that's the line that's drawn. I know that in Goodwin, it was something that happened as a criminal conviction that happened subsequently. And in another case, it was facts that were developed later, or you know, the fact that the defendant had gone to trial later. But
it ought to be the same rule, we agree. Like same analysis we're applying over on the sentencing side ought to apply over here.
I don't think so, because this case is different. Because what happened after Villa prevailed on his suppression motion was that unfortunately the prosecutor was exposed as not having investigated his case previously. To put it bluntly, it made him look bad. And nobody likes to have their mistakes exposed to judges or their bosses. And Villa's successful motion exposed that the prosecutor hadn't prepared his case, which provides motivation for a vindictive charging decision. So in that situation, I think it is distinguishable from the situation in which a sentencing judge learns additional information that existed but that he was not aware of previously. So my time has run, and I'll just, in conclusion, ask the court to vacate the judgment, instruct the district court to dismiss the indictment, or alternatively, to order the suppression of Villa's fingerprints and the evidence derived from them. Thank you.
Great. You've got some time on rebuttal. Ms. Ray?
May it please the court, Amy Ray for the United States. Your Honors, the district court properly denied both motions to dismiss and the motion to suppress. I want to begin with the vindictive prosecution argument and say that, you know, there are two requirements. There has to be a motive, a vindictive motive, and also, but for that vindictive motive, the new charges would not have been filed. Now, what the Supreme Court has held and this court has recognized is a presumption plays a role when the defendant cannot show those two things. But the presumption plays a really important role, which is it serves the purpose of allowing the court to find a vindictive motive where the circumstances suggest that that motive was likely. And that means all of the circumstances. Now, contrary to Ms. Hester's argument, this court and the Supreme Court have made clear that a pretrial decision to add charges is usually not vindictive. It actually requires a higher standard, if anything, than a post-conviction claim of vindictive prosecution. The purpose of the presumption is because what lies behind all of it is to make sure that defendants do not feel deterred from exercising their constitutional rights. And so the question becomes, would a defendant in this defendant's position, would a reasonable defendant feel deterred based on the totality of the circumstances? And what Goodwin says is, it's not just where a prosecutor finds new evidence, but it can also be where a prosecutor has a greater appreciation. Goodwin in the Supreme Court specifically recognized that part of a prosecution decision and process is where a prosecutor may realize later in the prosecution process that the evidence has more significance than she or he realized. Now, we take very serious issue with the suggestion that our prosecutor failed to prepare for trial or wasn't ready for something, or in fact did anything wrong. And the district court found that the prosecutor did nothing wrong in this case. The prosecutor explained.
Counsel, I'm sorry. Yes. Can I ask you a question, Ms. Ray, about Goodwin and your argument? So I don't understand you to be arguing, but tell me if I'm wrong, that, you know, as a matter of law, there can be no presumption in the pretrial context, like end of story. I take you to be arguing that, you know, Goodwin suggested, and we have said since then, like, you know, it's pretty, it's rare that you would find that presumption in the pretrial context. Maybe there shouldn't be one at all, but that you are arguing whatever, we don't have to reach that here because clearly on the facts of this case, no presumption. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that it never could occur. I am saying, though, that this court hasn't found it yet. And I am saying that Ladeau is easily distinguishable, and this court has not gone as far as the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit has recognized and found pretrial presumptions to be appropriate. Now, it is not to say that this court couldn't under certain circumstances. The reason I mentioned Goodwin is because the suggestion that a prosecutor has a duty at the beginning of the case to find every piece of evidence that supports the most serious charge that she could lodge against a defendant and then doesn't do that, that the suggestion that they have to do that or be susceptible to a claim of vindictive prosecution, a presumption that she was vindictive in prosecuting, is just makes no sense whatsoever. And it's not particularly, it is completely divorced from the point of the vindictive prosecution, which is to say, would a defendant feel deterred? Well, the district court found a defendant in these circumstances would not be deterred because the prosecutor didn't know that he had been convicted of two serious felony convictions in Georgia, or that he had been illegally that he had been deported and come back. Now, let's be clear. Part of why the prosecutor did not know is because his case agent ran the criminal history and none of it came up. So even though the pretrial services report existed, which was not conclusive, especially on the deportation issue, the case agent ran the criminal history of Francisco Villa, and neither his prior deportation nor the prior convictions came up. They didn't know about it. And there's no duty for them to know about it. This isn't a Brady situation. This is, when is it reasonable to impute vindictive purpose? And it's not reasonable, and the district court, as an abuse of discretion standard of review, was very reasonable in determining that it wasn't there's no reasonable likelihood of a vindictive purpose in under the circumstances of this case. And one other point I would make about Ladeau, in addition to just sort of factually it's distinguishable, it also came up in the inverse procedural context, which is that in Ladeau, the district court applied the presumption. So on appeal, the question was, did the district court abuse its discretion in finding that presumption? Here, it's the opposite. The district court did not find the presumption applied. Is it an abuse of discretion? And the answer is no. Turning to the suppression issue, here's the rule from Oscar Torres. When police use an illegal arrest as an investigatory device in a criminal case for the purpose of obtaining fingerprints without a warrant or probable cause, that's when those fingerprints should be suppressed. So when they use an illegal arrest, we have no illegal arrest here. Whether or not the officers intended to arrest the defendant based on the vape pen that they found in his car or based on the additional vape pens they found in the house is immaterial, because they found evidence in the car. It's an objective standard. It matters not what the officers intended to do or why they chose to arrest him or whether or not they intended to based on one or the other, right? It's an objective standard. The objective standard is they had a vape pen from the car that independently supported his arrest. And he was arrested for paraphernalia and they fingerprinted him for that on the basis of his arrest for those vape pens. So there was no evidence, and detention officer Steele testified that what happens is the magistrate judge brings a copy, brings the charge to the defendant, and on that is checked, fingerprint or no fingerprint. But we had no illegal arrest that triggers that analysis. But if we get to that analysis, the district court did not clearly err in finding that the purpose of this arrest was not to obtain the fingerprints, it was to prosecute him for marijuana possession and possibly for the firearms. But at the end of the day, the fingerprints were not necessary, and they were taken as an administrative, as part of an administrative process. The Speedy Trial Act issue, I think, turns in large part on the same issues that are presented in the vindictive prosecution claim, other than at least the first part of it, which is, you know, what is the date that we go from when we're calculating how long between the indictment and the trial? Do we begin with when he was originally indicted on the firearm charge, or do we begin when he was indicted on the illegal reentry case? I want to address one thing, which is, you know, this was this prosecutor's journey, honest journey from, you know, realizing that his trial was coming up, asking his case agent to get the fingerprints, and then the case agent, or to run, the case agent actually offered, should I go ahead and run those fingerprints? And this was before the suppression order entered. And she said, yeah, so they went ahead and did it. And then shortly after the suppression order was entered, they came back and realized, okay, he's got, he illegally was deported before and he illegally reentered. So it the date starts from the time of the indictment of the for the illegal reentry offense. So there's not really a Sixth Amendment analysis, but even if there is, even if we go through the Barker factors, the district court did not clearly err in its assessment of those factors.
Ms. Ray, let me ask you this.
Yes,
under the circumstances, could you have obtained a superseding indictment in this case?
We don't think so, but I'll respond to that with a couple of points. One, at the time that we decided to indict Mr. Villa, we knew that the other charges were going to be dismissed. Now, this is, you know, we were also just in all candor to the court discussing whether to appeal that decision. And there were some pretty intense discussions about that. But we did know that that indictment was going to be, that those charges would be dismissed. It didn't make a lot of sense to try to supersede. But even if we had, I would suggest that no, we couldn't. Or at least it would not be advisable to try to supersede based on the illegal reentry charge. The facts that we had to prove, the elements, were very, very different. The only similar element was that he was an illegal alien. But also, there's a chance that the defendant would have moved to sever because he probably would not have wanted the evidence of his prior convictions to be presented to the jury that we considered his firearm offense. So we did not think that it was appropriate to supersede. It was considered, but it seemed like the most logical choice when we were faced with the fact that we were going to be dismissing the firearm charge anyway was to indict anew. And I will say there was no concern at that point about speedy trial issues. That was not part of the calculus. Yes.
Oh, go ahead, Judge Harris.
Go ahead, Judge Rushing. There you go.
On the superseding indictment question, I'm looking at what other circuits have said about this question of when the speedy trial right, when that clock starts running for constitutional purposes, when you have new charges, does it matter that the charges are brought in a superseding indictment versus in a new indictment and a new case? Or it seemed to me it matters more how similar the conduct is or whether it arises out of the same transaction. I don't know, courts have different standards for this, and I know the parties didn't really take a position on that, but how relevant is whether it's in a superseding indictment or not to your analysis?
So I would say, Judge Rushing, that I did not find, and the defendant didn't cite a case where it was held that there was a new indictment and that related back to the original, and those cases may exist. But it is important whether or not in the superseding context, how close they were and whether or not they are tied to a similar set of facts. And these aren't. This wasn't. He possessed eight firearms in his house. That was the primary conduct that we were talking about with the firearm offense, and obviously very different conduct with the illegal reentry offense. So I don't
Seems
think
like maybe it was, that the conduct question should. I mean, the indictment question is really up to the government, right? I mean, the defendant can move to sever or whatever, but you know, it's up to you guys whether you choose to put it in a superseding indictment or a new one. So I should that factor into the rule at all?
I mean, I don't think so unless there's, you know, it, perhaps in a context in which it was very clear that we could and should have. I mean, it's hard for me to even imagine that circumstance, because then you're more likely in the vindictive prosecution realm, I would suggest, than in a Speedy Trial Act or Speedy Trial constitutional violation context. Here, we just didn't have, we didn't think that the facts supported filing a superseding indictment. We did not think that they were close enough under the joinder rules of Rule 8 and the factors that we would consider. And again, we knew that the indictment was going to be, the charge against him on the firearm charge was going to be dismissed anyway when we made the decision.
And that second point about the joinder, I mean, it's not strictly the same, but that's, I think, really where the action is, right? As are these, you know, other courts are looking at, is this conduct similar enough? Is it all, does it all come out of the same transaction? Are there different elements? You know, whatever their standards are, they're looking at, you know, whether the clock should relate back to the original indictment based on the similarity between the charges.
Right, because at the end of the day, what's the question? Whether or not the defendant would be prejudiced by it all. I mean, it really comes down to, and a defendant is not prejudiced if you're talking about brand new charges that don't relate back and there's no unfairness. And that's why the Barker test is a balancing test. And the most, one of two of the most important factors are, did the defendant assert his speedy trial right in a timely manner? And could he show prejudice? And none of those things, the district court didn't clearly err in finding that he didn't show prejudice in this point, in this case, certainly not prejudice that's related to the speedy trial concerns, which are trial concerns and not sentencing concerns. And this court held in Lozano, for example, that sentencing concerns generally are too speculative. It was in Lozano. And so the possibility of an appeal is just too speculative to fall within the kind of Sixth Amendment speedy trial concerns that the Sixth Amendment protects. So, yes, I
can
think
I ask you
the question. Yes, Judge Harris.
Can I ask you a question about the other end of the clock that I found confusing? You know, in part of your brief, you argue, actually fall back pretty fast to look, even if we assume for a minute that the first indictment starts the clock, we're only talking about 14 months here. We're talking about the time between the first indictment and I think between the second indictment, 14 months. But why would the clock stop at the second indictment? Why doesn't it stop at, on the date of the trial or maybe the day on which the district court rules on the speedy trial motion? I don't understand why it stops when the second indictment is filed. Assuming for a minute, this is just your alternative argument, that it starts with the first indictment or the first arrest.
Yeah, it doesn't. That was my mistake.
Oh,
so,
okay.
And I apologize for that mistake. that was
is
my
that
mistake.
Right, though? I was really confused about that, about the amount of delay, because we have cases where we only count the delay, which we don't call the whole period. It's just the period that seemed like inappropriate, I guess, or the period that wasn't the defendant's fault. I really was pretty confused about what is delay and what is not. For purposes of the Constitution.
Thank you, Judge Rushing, and clearly I was as well. I guess when I went back to it and sort of looked at it, I thought after I read Ms. Hester's reply brief, I thought, yeah, okay, there were definitely cases that talk about trial between the indictment and the trial. And so I figured, truthfully, I don't think that 19 months versus 14 months as a constitutional matter really matters very much. And if we look at the cases and what kinds of delays have been held to be constitutionally infirm, 19 months really isn't in the ballpark unless the defendant can show a prejudice that the defendant hasn't shown in this case. But I just felt like when I looked at it all that I probably should have erred on the side of acknowledging. So hence my statement today that I think there were cases that say it ends at the trial. So from the indictment to the trial, and of course the Fifth Amendment is from up to the date, the time of indictment, pre-indictment delay.
Right.
Sorry, Judge Harris, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Judge Rushen.
Well, I was curious about whether we remove the time that the defendant asked for a delay, and because not only because he asked for it, and he asked for it not just because the magistrate judge had ruled that was not the reason, but he also says he's waiving his speedy trial rights. And he doesn't restrict it to the Speedy Trial Act. He says, I'm waiting my speedy trial rights. So do we take that amount of time out of what it counts as delay, or is that not relevant under how this is counted? I really don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But I think that this court could choose to say that he waived it with respect to the constitutional analysis because it wasn't, because he didn't use those words. You know, I'm intentionally waiving my constitutional claim. Then I feel like it also probably, if I were looking at it, would say that that does count in terms of the time. But where those continuances come in fairly is, of course, the reasons for the delay once we get to those Barker factors. So I think that he's shown enough to get to the Barker factors if, and it's really important if we start from that first indictment, which I don't think this court can or should. But if we start from the first indictment, then I think he gets to the Barker factors, and those factors the district court reasonably found weigh against a finding of a constitutional violation. If your honors don't have any further questions, we respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of the district court and hold that this prosecutor did not, there was no insufficient evidence of vindictive prosecution. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Hester, you've got some time. And can I actually start you with a question about the speedy trial clock?
Yes.
I spent way too much time trying to figure out the stop date for the clock. And it seemed to me that we have not been entirely clear about this, but that it's supposed to be either the time of the trial or maybe the time the district court rules on the motion, because at that moment, the district court may not know how much more delay will be involved. But in this case, the district court said specifically in its opinion that, at least as the district court understood it, your challenge was confined to the delay before the second indictment, 14 months, and that you were raising no challenge to the delay between the indictment and the scheduled trial date in January. So the district court thought the only issue in front of it was the 14 months between the arrest and the second indictment. So what do I do with that?
Well, I mean, I think the reason for that, of course, is because that's the amount of time that had elapsed at the time that the motion was being considered.
Time had elapsed by the time the motion was being considered, but.
So I'm not sure what to do with that, except to say that I think that the delay that was attributable to the government's failure to investigate, I mean, I would agree that all of that delay had occurred by the time they had recharged and the district court had ruled on the second set of motions. I mean, by that time, the court was moving the case along. I mean, really, the delay was the district court's failure to move on the initial suppression motion for 10 months and the government's failure to investigate their case, which caused them to then bring a new indictment after the first one was dismissed, whereas if they had brought it all together, that second, you know, litigation of that second case wouldn't have been necessary. But I don't have a clear bright line test for the court, I'm afraid, under those circumstances. I would like to move back to the vindictive prosecution issue. It appears that the government is now arguing that Ladeau should not apply. They did not argue that in their brief. I don't think they should be heard to argue that now. But in any event, they can't cite a case that rejects the Ladeau rule. And this isn't a pretrial charging decision. The only reason that this did not occur post conclusion of the original case is because the government was had the control over whether that case got dismissed or not. So as Ladeau found, this is the equivalent of a post-trial decision to recharge. It's basically the same type of situation that it would be after a person appeals and requires the government to start over from square one. The effect is the same either way. The government also argues that the prosecutor didn't know, and that should distinguish this case from others in which the presumption of vindictiveness is applied. But again, they don't cite any case where a prosecutor had information and didn't look at it, and that prevented the presumption of vindictiveness from applying. And if the court looks again at those cases that I cited, Goodwin, North Carolina versus Pierce, Blackledge, this court's decision on Wilson, all of those cases talk about impossibility of proceeding on the charges at the outset. And as I explained, the exposure of the prosecutor's failure to prepare his case, which is essentially what the government's arguing, that can't be a valid reason because it is not inconsistent with a vindictive motive. It's quite consistent with a vindictive motive that a prosecutor, just like any other person, having his mistake exposed would have a motivation to be vindictive in response. With respect to the government's argument about abuse of discretion on the vindictive prosecution issue, that really doesn't matter because it's a legal question for this court to decide whether the district court ruled in favor or against the vindictive prosecution issue. It's all legal issues that this court reviews de novo either way. And finally, the government's articulation of the Oscar Torres rule would limit that rule to what Hayes and Davis said. And this court in Oscar Torres expressly stated that it was going beyond the rule that was stated in Hayes and Davis. So the government's articulation of that rule is just not workable.
Counsel, how can we go beyond the rule articulated in Hayes and Davis? I think I'm just misunderstanding what you're saying. I mean, obviously, Hayes and Davis, you know, set the rules for us in terms of how to do that attenuation inquiry in this context. How can we go beyond that? What do you mean by
well,
that?
Well, actually, they didn't because what the Supreme Court said in Davis versus Mississippi is fingerprint evidence is no exception to the exclusionary rule. It was just applying it in that particular situation, and it noted other situations that it didn't have occasion to consider, such as whether police could obtain fingerprints on reasonable suspicion or with, you know, something less than probable cause.
Right, whether they can in the field. Right. That's not implicated here.
No, that's not implicated here. But I think, well, what the court said in Oscar Torres is that the rule we're articulating is not expressly articulated in Hayes and Davis because it's a different situation. But I think that the court, the Oscar Torres rule is peculiar to the immigration context. I think absent that administrative detention, the court simply applies the Wong-Sun exclusionary rule and asks whether the taint is so attenuated that exclusionary rule doesn't apply. Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for appearing before us this afternoon and for your assistance. And we are sorry we cannot greet you in person, but we hope that you stay well and that we will see you in Richmond very soon.
Thank you, Judge Harris. Thank you all.